From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we begin a week of interviews with cultural heroes and one-of-a-kinds. We kick off with two men who changed the course of pop music. Guitarist Les Paul invented the solid-body electric guitar, overdubbing, reverb, and multi-tracking, inventions which made rock and roll possible. Sam Phillips founded the Memphis-based label Sun Records. He discovered Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, Johnny Cash, and Roy Orbison. And before he started his own label, he produced the first records of B.B. King and Howlin' Wolf. Two men who changed the course of pop music history, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Residents of eastern North Carolina once again find themselves bracing for high water in the wake of Hurricane Irene. It's the third hurricane to hit the state in 2 months. Lita Hartman has more.
Irene dumped 4 to 6 inches of rain on most of North Carolina's coastal plain and up to a foot of rain near the city of New Bern. Already the storm has inundated dozens of secondary roads, and the flooding will get worse as the week goes on. 5 major rivers in the east are expected to rise above flood stage in the next few days. The heaviest flooding will likely be in the same places that suffered most after Hurricane Floyd: Tarboro, Kinston, Greenville, and Fayetteville. Still, emergency management officials say conditions could be worse. Irene's flooding will not be as severe or as widespread as Floyd's. Meanwhile, Governor Jim Hunt and the state legislature are floating ideas to raise money to help the East continue recovering. The proposals include a tax increase, spending cuts, a $1 million bond issue, and a public works project to build dams on several rivers. For NPR News, I'm Lita Hartman reporting.
The Republican leader in the House says he and his GOP colleagues are excited about a meeting with President Clinton on the budget, but Dick Armey says that Republicans are not interested in a budget summit. The White House and Republicans have been battling over spending priorities for weeks, with each side accusing the other of raiding Social Security. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican Jesse Helms of North Carolina, says he'll block the nomination of a former Democratic senator as ambassador to New Zealand. He says she should look for another job. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
Carol Mosley Braun was the first African-American woman to serve in the Senate, one term until she was defeated last year. Helms was quoted over the weekend saying she shouldn't hold her breath waiting for confirmation. Officially, Helms says Mosley Braun is under an ethical cloud because she was too close to a Nigerian dictator and misused campaign funds. Mosley Braun has denied the allegations. Unofficially, a 1993 fight between the two senators may be significant. Mosley Braun mobilized senators against the United Daughters of the Confederacy, which had a bill approving its use of the Confederate battle flag as its emblem. Helms says she should apologize to the organization. President Clinton said today he hopes Helms won't derail the nomination. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
The investigation of President Clinton and the First Lady is no longer in the hands of Kenneth Starr. He's returning to his private law practice, and a panel of judges today formally approved his successor, Robert Ray. Ray promised to wrap up the 5-year probe, which has cost more than $40 million, in a prompt, responsible, and cost-effective manner. Stock prices were mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials closed up more than 96 points at 10116, while the Nasdaq was down 42. You're listening to NPR News. The Department of Health and Human Services is going ahead with a controversial regulation to change the way human organs are allocated for transplants. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
The regulations, first proposed in 1998, would require that organs be distributed more on the basis of medical need and less on geography. Currently, patients in different parts of the country wait dramatically different lengths of time for a transplant. But the United Network for Organ Sharing, which runs the transplant system under contract to the government, complained that the rules could result in organs going to patients who are not the best medical candidates and might force smaller transplant centers to close. Congress intervened by imposing a 1-year moratorium on the rules. But HHS Secretary Donna Shalala said that the rules have been changed to address those concerns. They do not require organs to be shipped across the country, she said, nor require organs to be given to patients too sick to benefit. The rules will take effect 30 days after the congressional moratorium expires. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
The Food and Drug Administration is getting ready to hear from the Republic about about bioengineered food. Officials will hold hearings around the country. U.S. scientists, as well as biotech corporations and farmers, have been surprised by growing public concern and resistance, especially abroad. In Britain, critics deride biotech as frankenfood. In the United States, critics now demand labels on bioengineered food. Health experts insist biotech foods are already safe. A strong earthquake that rocked Southern California and parts of the Southwest have prompted geologists to take a closer look at a new fault line called LAVIC. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publishers of A Very Private Woman by Nina Burley, the story of the life and mysterious death of Mary Meyer, in trade paperback. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we begin a week-long series of interviews with cultural heroes and one-of-a-kinds.
It's the Les Paul Show.
Hi. Hello, folks. Let's see, I've got my guitar, I got my wife, Mary.
Hi.
And I got a room just loaded with electronics. We've got some inventions here that make one voice sound like many voices and one guitar like many guitars. And by means of these 6L6s and plugging them into this amplifier, why, we managed to...
Well, why don't you grab a guitar and show the people what you can do?
All right, I got a lot of ideas. Here we go. Now, that's one guitar. Now, if you want two, I just throw a switch.
How about three?
Easy. Now, if you want four, switch.
How about five?
It's a cinch.
Les Paul has spent his life playing guitar, inventing guitars to play, and inventing devices to record himself with. He's invented so much, he's often been called the Thomas Edison of music. For starters, he invented the solid body electric guitar, overdubbing, reverb, and multi-tracking, inventions that help make rock and roll possible. But Paul himself has stuck to jazz and more middle-of-the-road pop. In the 1950s, he had several hits with his wife, Mary Ford, including How High the Moon, Vaya Con Dios, and Bye Bye Blues. At the age of 84, Les Paul is still playing once a week in New York at the club Iridium. He lives in New Jersey in a home with four recording studios. He used one of those studios to talk with us back in 1992. We began with a recording he made in his garage studio in 1948, the recording he describes as the first that combined his inventions and recording techniques into one bag of tricks. The song is Lover.
Thank you.
Les Paul, welcome to Fresh Air. So is that you playing all the parts?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Was this the first record that you overdubbed on?
Oh, no. No, I started it in 1933. I started in the 20s by punching holes in my mother's piano rolls. But I did it because the rhythm guitar player and bass player would go home and I'd say, darn it, I wanted to have him play Limehouse Blues and I wanted to try something. And I'd say, well, as long as they're not here, what I'll do is I'll play the bass and I'll play the guitar and I'll do that. But I never recognized that that could be such a tremendous tool.
What was different on this recording of Lover from anything that you'd ever done before?
Well, the sped-up sound, the echo, the playing the bass line, making a guitar sound like a bass. This is the first time in history that anybody had ever done anything like that. And then to speed the guitar up and slow the guitar down, and you get all these different sounds by muffling your strings with your wrist, and these were all new things to be exposed to the world. And of course, I had my problems because so many people weren't ready to accept it.
So on Lover, the high, fast, trebly sounds that we hear, that's a sped-up guitar?
Mm-hmm. Along with the normal guitar, mm-hmm. The whole idea there is to be able to get octaves and to go an octave below and an octave above and to do all the harmony parts and everything, you know. And that was not the very first record I ever made that way, but like I say, it was the first. That was the first one to come out. And that came out about a week after I had an automobile accident where for 2 years I was to be in the hospital in a basket. everything I had was broken and I was in bad shape for about 2 years. So I had a lot of time to think and I unfortunately... didn't have that many records in the can, so to speak. What I had are records that were completely done except for the last part, which was the melody. And the reason I left that melody off is I figured that every week that went by, I got better. And if I got better, why, I had newer ideas. And so I'd leave that last part off. And after the automobile accident, I had to do the next recordings in a cast, a body cast. And so with one arm fixed right up even with my face in air, the only thing I could move with my right hand was my thumb. So I put a thumb pick on that, laid the guitar. And I had a rack built to hold the guitar horizontal, and it laid there flat, and I just stood up and played my part, and that's how I made the parts for the next 4 or 5 records.
Now let me get to one of the hits that you had. Let's talk about How High the Moon, which you recorded with Mary Ford, one of your big hits.
Thank you.
Let's hear some of it.
Where there's music, I'll paint the tune. Where there's heaven, how high the moon. There is no moon above, love is far away too. Till it comes true that you love me, it's out of use. Where there's music, ponder how far. Where there's heaven, it's where you are. The darkest night would shine if you would come to me soon. Until you will still my heart, how high the moon.
How would you record Mary's voice to get that echo?
Well, that was something that I spent 2 years trying to find out I didn't want reverb like an empty room. I didn't want Carnegie Hall. I didn't want that sound. I said to my friend, very dear friend, he and his girlfriend, Mary was my girlfriend, and myself, and a fellow named Wally Jones, we were all sitting in a little tavern at Santa Monica and Western out in Hollywood, and Lloyd was arm wrestling with me, and we had a pitcher of beer and some popcorn, and we're watching the fights on Friday night. And he pulled my arm down really easy, and he says, "Les, you're not concentrating. You're usually pretty rough to bring that arm down on." And I said, "Well, I'm thinking of that echo." And I said, "I haven't figured that delay out yet. I haven't figured it out." And he says, "Well, you still worried about that thing?" And I says, "Yeah, I need it. I need it, and I don't know how to get it." And he says, "Well, explain it to me again." And so this night, Lloyd, I explained it to Lloyd again. I says, "Picture that you're on the Alps." I say, "Hello, hello, hello, hello." And I said, "I want it to repeat, and I want it to repeat, and I want the delay and the decay I want to be able to vary it." And lo and behold, he says to me, "You mean like putting the playback head behind the record head?" Oh, boy, I threw $10 down on the table, and I said to Wally, "Pay the bill and bring the girls," you know. And we left him with the $10 bill and the girls, and the beer and the popcorn and the TV were gone. And by the time they got home, you could hear all over the neighborhood, "Hello, hello, hello, hello," you know? And we'd found the echo, the delay.
You know what I want to know? Why did you want to have echo on her voice?
That's interesting, because I felt as though when you play the note dry, just dead, it just drops like a rock. And in this case, I didn't want that note to say, "Hey," and just go on like Carnegie Hall. I wanted to go, "Hey, hey." See? And now, if you want, you put a little tail on it. You go, "Hey, hey, 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 hey." You know? it gives you such command of so many things, the toys to work with.
Are you still inventing, or are you still in the process of creating things?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
What are you working on?
We're working on a bass, Les Paul bass, that will be at the NAMM show next week. We're working on all kinds of things. I've invented a thing for piano. I got another thing for high blood pressure. I got all kinds of things.
Something for high blood pressure?
Mm-hmm.
You getting into the medical field now?
Well, it's just that...
You need it.
Not that I need it. I saw that there was room for it in the medical world. There's a lot of things that you recognize if you're lying in bed and you see a guy do something that's the hard way. And you say, "You know, how come you're doing it that way?" Well, the same thing applies to... it goes all the way back to... Terry, if I can really take you way back, it's the first time that my mother, in her home, had a radio, a Victrola, okay? That's the gramophone, that's the phonograph, okay? And a player piano. And I'm sitting there with all these things. And I looked at it and I says, "You know, there's something interesting here. This piano, I can punch a hole in it wherever I wish, and that note will come out. And I can slow it down and speed up, and it doesn't change pitch. Okay? It just gets slower or faster. If I put my hand on a phonograph record and I slow it down, the pitch changes. Why?" And that's the key to the whole thing, that curiosity of that you just ask that question, why? And you got your life cut out for you.
Well, Les Paul, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Smiling through. Don't sigh, don't cry. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Our interview with Les Paul was recorded in 1992. Coming up, our series on cultural heroes and one-of-a-kinds continues with Sam Phillips, the man who first recorded Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, Roy Orbison, and B.B. King. This is Fresh Air. Throughout this week, we're featuring a special archive series of interviews with cultural heroes and one-of-a-kinds. Ringo Starr, Mickey Spillane, and the late Allen Ginsberg are just some of the people you'll hear. We do our best to keep you in touch with the people who've changed our culture. In fact, we think public radio has helped change the culture by giving us a place to hear lengthy, reflective interviews with the most interesting writers, artists, and performers of our time. Keeping it going is worth your pledge. I hope you agree and that you'll call now. Thank you. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun Records. Phillips discovered and first recorded Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, and Roy Orbison. First, our rock and roll historian Ed Ward explores Phillips' early producing days and the pre-rockabilly Sun.
When people mention Sun Records, the immediate association is, yeah, the greatest rockabilly label of all time, the place where Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins and many more got their start. What most people don't realize is that Sam Phillips, the man who ran Sun in the studio where all those people recorded, would never have made it to 1954 to record Elvis if it hadn't been for all the blues he recorded there earlier. Phillips had started as a disc jockey at various Memphis stations, and it was there that he noticed something. The Negroes had no place to record in the South, he told an interviewer much later. They had to go up to Chicago or New York to get on record, and even the most successful of the local entertainers had a hard time doing that. Sam noticed that Saul and Jules Beharie, who owned the successful L.A. label Modern, were recording Memphis blues artists in garages. So he scraped together enough money to lease a small building at 706 Union Avenue for $150 a month, and soon he was making records for the Beharie brothers in a clean, modern studio.
Be careful what you're driving, man. That Cadillac may get away. You better be careful. Down standing the highway, man. Standing parked on the road. Down standing the highway, man. Parked on the road. You better watch out for the red light just before you go.
Local favorites like Chester Burnett, the Howlin' Wolf, made records that blacks all over the country bought, and soon Sam was sending tapes not only to Los Angeles, but to Chicago. He got burned one time too often, though, and finally decided that if anybody should be pressing up these great singers, he should be the one. So in 1952, he asked an old high school friend to design him a record label showing a rooster crowing at a rising sun, and Sun Records was born. The first record issued on the label was Blues in My Condition by Jackie Boy and Little Walter, and was supposedly so bad that after testing it out on Memphis radio, Sam withdrew it. But Easy, the song we started with, showed Walter Horton in better shape and sold pretty well. But soon, he had to withdraw another record.
You said about me, don't you, woman? Well, you ain't nothing but a bearcat. Been scratching at my door. You ain't nothing but a bearcat. Been scratching at my door. You can purr, pretty kitty, but I ain't gonna rub you no more.
Rufus Thomas's Bearcat was a straight-ahead copy of Willie Mae Thornton's huge hit Hound Dog, and Sam pulled the song rather than face the lawsuit that got slapped on him. But there was plenty of talent around. Nobody needed to plagiarize anybody else. Sam tried next with Dr. Isaiah Ross, a rural-sounding harmonica player from Tunica, Mississippi. ¶¶ This was too countrified for black buyers outside the South, though, so Sam headed to Beale Street for his next star.
Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train carried my baby home.
Little Junior Parker was the fastest rising star in Memphis, a veteran of a number of blues bands, including Sonny Boy Williamson's and Howlin' Wolf's. And Son made him a star with Mystery Train and this classic.
You know, the other day, I was walking down the street. I met a friend of mine. And we stopped and get a little something to eat. When I got to him, I said, "Say, man, look here." He said, "Yeah, Junior, what's happening?" I told him, "Whoa! Feel so good. We're gonna boogie till the break of day." I said, "Look at here." He said, "What is it?" "Well, the old folks boogie and the children too. Don't nobody boogie like me and you. We're gonna boogie."
Unfortunately, Parker became such a star that he soon signed with another label and went on to stardom elsewhere. By 1954, Sam may well have been disillusioned with blues singers and their inconstancy. He'd started out watching them make money for others, and then he'd raised a crop of his own, only to watch them wander off. Maybe hillbilly singers would be a better bet, he decided, and set about recording some of them. And yet, as he often told Marion Keisker, his secretary, if he could only find a white boy with the Negro sound and feel. Little did Sam know that he'd find him soon, and that one of the first things he'd want to record would be Junior Parker's old Sun Blues hit, Mystery Train.
Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train got my baby and gone.
Ed Ward currently lives and works in Germany. We'll hear from Sam Phillips in the second half of our show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, and this is NPR National Public Radio.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right.
Coming up, Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun Records. He was the first to record Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Roy Orbison, Johnny Cash, and B.B. King.
Well, Mama, she done told me, Papa done told me too. Son, that guy you foolin' with, she ain't no good for you. But that's all right, that's all right.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown & Company, publishers of The Trust, the private and powerful family behind The New York Times by Susan E. Tift and Alex S. Jones, in hardcover wherever books are sold. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. And from the Animal Protection Institute, working since 1968 to protect animals from cruelty and abuse. Information at 1-800-348-7387.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're featuring a special series of interviews with cultural heroes and one-of-a-kinds. Sam Phillips changed the course of American music. He discovered Elvis and produced his first records, which many consider Elvis's best.
Well, I heard you knew good to rockin' tonight. She'll know I'm a mighty, mighty man. I heard the news. There's good to rock it tonight. I say, oh, meet me in a hurry behind the bar. Don't you be afraid, darling, do you no harm. I want you to bring along my rocking shoes, cause tonight I'm going to rock away all my blues. I heard the news. There's good to rock it tonight.
Discovering Elvis would have been enough to ensure Sam Phillips an important place in music history, but he's done even more than that. He founded Sun Records in Memphis, which launched the careers of Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, Johnny Cash, Roy Orbison, and Charlie Rich. Before Phillips started his own record label, he produced the first records of bluesmen B.B. King and Howlin' Wolf. As Elvis's biographer Peter Goralnik says, Phillips has left a remarkable legacy, both of black blues and the white adaptation of it, which became rock and roll. He has written one of the most astonishing chapters in the history of American popular music, and for this we can only be grateful. Sam Phillips sold Sun Records in 1969. He still lives in Memphis. I spoke with him in 1997. When Elvis first auditioned for you, I know that he sang in styles of his favorite performers, from, you know, white and black, from Lonnie Johnson to Dean Martin. What did you do to try to get a sense from Elvis of who Elvis really was, of what his kind of own voice was?
Well, Elvis being as young as he was, and of course I'm 12 years and 3 days older than Elvis, and he's 19, I guess I was 31 or whatever. But I can tell you, the only time that we possibly had what you might say a difference of opinion in what we were doing is that I really did not want to do some of the quote-unquote more popish things that Elvis truly did like, because Elvis, let's face it, had an absolute beautiful voice from the beginning. Trained or not, it was beautiful. But at the same time, he also had a certain intrigue about his voice, and I knew that. And I knew that we needed to feel our way around between great gut bucket blues and country. I really, truly thought that. And so I think Elvis, if he had had his way, and he absolutely gave us no problem at all on it, maybe he wouldn't have put a country-type thing on the backside of each R&B record that we put out on him, or each quote-unquote black-oriented record. But I thought that was a thing to do at the time.
Do you have a favorite of the Elvis Sun Sessions that...
I really do, and I really do, and I've kidded about it a lot because I wrote the song. I really didn't. It was the song Mystery Train that Little Junior Parker really basically wrote it, and we did it by him on Sun, and we did it at an entirely different tempo and approach, and he had the idea for the song and came in, and it wasn't quite like we thought it should be, and so I worked with him a little bit because I really did love the idea of the song. And so when we decided to do it on Elvis, it is something that I think that we did so entirely different. Although Little Junior Parker's record was Elvis's favorite of the two, I have to say that both of them were my favorites, and I till this day I'd have to say Mystery Train ranks way up there. But anyway, on the records that I did on Elvis, I mean, I really did like all the things I did on him. I really did. Now, you know, hey, I'm trying not to be partial at all, but
okay.
I mean, I really am, because, I mean, I just liked what we did. Everything from Your Heartbreaker. Now, that is absolutely the most nothing record in the world, except that it is something.
Why don't we hear, since you produced Junior Parker's version of Mystery Train Tune, why don't we hear both the Junior Parker and the Elvis version back to back?
We're in for a treat.
Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train carried my baby from home.
Train coming round, round the bend. Train, train coming round the bend. Well, it took my baby, but it never will again.
This Junior Parker and Elvis Presley, both of their versions of Mystery Train, both versions produced by my guest, Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun Records. You know, I have to ask you this. People are always saying that you used to say, before you discovered Elvis, that you used to say, if I could find a white man who had the Negro sound and the Negro feel, or if I could find a white man who could sing like a black man, I could make $1 million or $1 billion. Did you really say that? And if so, what did you mean?
In essence, I did, and I simply meant that there was no feel better than the feel of black people and their rhythm. I still, till this day, feel that is a true statement, regardless of the cultures that have changed to a great degree in many instances and just a slight degree in others. I just felt like that black music at that time did not have. You have to keep in mind, radio was the big deal then, before TV, and there was no way at that time. We got to go back, transpose ourselves 40-something years here, and realize that to get black artists played, it was very, very difficult because it wasn't that many stations on the air that were going to play black records. And I thought if we got a white person and people knew that he was a white person, that there was a good possibility that we could broaden the base for both black and white people that had talent. And that was my main reason for wanting to do that and making that statement.
A lot of listeners have spent a lot of time over the years wondering, how would music history have been different? How would Elvis have been different if you never sold his contract to RCA? I wonder if you lose a lot of sleep thinking about that, if you spend a lot of time thinking about that yourself.
I have not lost one wink of sleep about it. I did give Elvis advice that he really should produce his records when he left Sun, because Elvis had an excellent ear. Corporate vice presidents of big major labels, I don't think at all were into the idea of let's find something that truly is new and different. I'm taking nothing away from them personally, but that was just a fact of life. I knew that there were a lot of things that RCA put out on Elvis due to a lot of the motion pictures and everything that he was making that really weren't the best material in the world for Elvis to do. If I had had Elvis right on up until the day he died, I couldn't have kept Elvis ultimately from being a tremendous force in music and influence on people, even if I had tried. I do not regret whatsoever any of the things that took place between the time I sold Elvis and all of this that we have even today. And you say, well, you mean all of that money and that total effect that has been had around the world? I feel like I was absolutely a part of that. And I don't care anything about claiming any credit for it, but I was a part of it because I recognized that Elvis Presley was unique, as I did so many, many other people that had no opportunity whatsoever.
When artists like Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis were getting played on the radio, and it was just scandalous to a lot of people, you know, the power and the sexuality of the music terrified a lot of adults, PTAs, church groups. What did you make of all of the fuss about early rock and roll, a lot of which you were responsible for? I mean, did you think it was funny? Did you think it was scary? What did it mean to you?
No, I really did not think it was funny. I really seriously considered the fact that I knew that this was going to happen. People truly believed, a lot of people, you can call them hypocrites or whatever, but I can understand they thought that this was absolutely going to be the end of the world. And I saw it and I felt it, but at the same time, I thought this is just really one of the things that we will have to endure in order to find out whether or not what we feel about it is right. And if it's not right, then all they say is not going to kill it. If it is right, it will make it.
Were you attacked personally in any way?
Not personally, no. I was, physically, but personally, oh yeah, my name was called quite frequently across the country, and especially in churches. And I'm a good old Southern Baptist, and whatever that is, but that really, really, not that I wasn't cognizant of the people's real concern about this, but they had forgotten that the toughest time in a person's life, and I think any psychologist in this world will tell you this, is during the teenage years of anybody's existence. And teenagers did not have, before rock and roll and rhythm and blues, they did not have any type of music they could call their own once they got over 4 or 5 years old, until they were well into their 20s and were considered adults. So I just felt that this was a vast field that had been overlooked by just about everybody, and that if we had a white person that they could justify maybe a little bit to their parents that, well, you know, it's a white boy or whatever. Maybe the actual feeling of resentment might not be quite as steeped in the racial aspects of it.
My guest is Sam Phillips. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Blue moon, you saw me standing alone without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Blue moon, you knew just what I was there for. You heard me saying a prayer for someone I really care for.
My guest is Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun Records. His discoveries include Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Johnny Cash. Did you ever wish that you were the performer and you weren't behind the glass in the control room, but you were in front of the microphone,
never,
in front of the crowd?
Never, never, never. And that's a good question. That's probably one of the better ones, Terry, because that's another thing. I was never, ever jealous. I was a pretty good musician. I've always said I wasn't worth a damn, but my bandmaster and everything at Coffee High School said I was good. I directed a band in the summer. and this sort of thing. But no, that did not enter my mind. Mine was strictly the laboratory, and that's where I was happy. Oh, it'd have been great to go out and had a little fun with a horn. I played the tuba and played the drums and I played the sousaphone and that sort of thing. But no, no, listen, I had the good job. I had the good job. The boys out there on the floor, they had the tough job. They had to worry about one instrument. I had to worry about three, maybe, you know.
I think you just answered one of my questions. You said you played tuba when you were younger. You had said at one place that your favorite composer was John Philip Sousa. Now, I mean, I love marching band music. I love band music and marches and stuff. But I was really shocked to hear that from you, the man who discovered Elvis Presley, John Philip Sousa.
Hey, you've been reading my record or something, girl. Let me tell you something about John Philip Sousa. I heard this man, anybody that can take a 4-4 beat, like practically all martial music is,
mm-hmm.
and you take it and you have it stiff, quote unquote stiff. I mean, and I'm not talking about marching as such, stiff legged, or, but you take what martial music is what I call stiff music. This man absolutely got more melody chords. I'm not talking about necessarily harmony chords because. Let's face it, martial music is not made up just for a nice big blend of harmony. But you listen to this guy and the way that he handled it. This guy is a master at crafting music that if you can make people want to listen to it, and if you can make somebody want to listen to a good martial piece of music like the Washington Post March or a Symphony Fidelis and enjoy it, I mean, I'm going to tell you, you are a master musician. He is the best. He is the best at what he did. There's not a good second. You can't name one. I would say probably some of the greatest directors in the world. And, of course, the Boston Pops has always been one of my favorite. That Fiedler was so crazy. I loved him, man. He was scared of nothing. Absolutely scared of nothing. The criticism, he didn't give a damn. Give him a drink before he went out on stage, a half a pint, and you can forget it, honey. You were going to have fun with music. And boy, did he help to separate the lines of demarcation in music and social affairs and I mean, you know, don't get me started.
No, wait. You mentioned that he'd have a little drink before. My understanding is that you wouldn't let your musicians have a drink in the studio, with the exception of Howlin' Wolf.
That is right. Damn you, woman, I swear to God. Do you have my jail record up there, too? But honestly, that's a fact. And the Wolf, I looked at him as big as he was, and then a half of a pint of Thunderbird wine, and actually that half pint was half gone already, and I said, you know, there can't be too much harm done if I permit him to break the rules around here. And besides that, if he stepped on me, I might be no more.
Now, what about other people? Why wouldn't you let them drink? Because, after all, you wanted them to be as relaxed and as natural and uninhibited as they could.
I don't really know. I really honestly don't know, Terry. There was just something I wanted to really get high on what we were attempting to do. And the one thing that I can tell you unequivocally again is that we did get high on our music. Even the cuts that we didn't feel that we had it on, we got high on it. And I want to tell you, there is no high in this world better than when you cut something that you didn't believe that you could do. You maybe said to yourself, I know I can do it, but you really didn't believe you could do it, and you do it. Now, you tell me something that would be more potentially high. Now, that's high-octane stuff, so far as I'm concerned.
Sam Phillips, recorded in 1997. This is Fresh Air. Elvis Presley may be about the most successful performer in pop music history, but it takes public radio to offer a reflective, in-depth interview with the man who discovered him.
This week, we're presenting a series of interviews with cultural heroes and one-of-a-kinds. These are the type of people you've come to expect on Fresh Air, people who've changed the course of American culture and have left us with music, books, movies, and art that we love. There is a price to pay to keep this kind of programming, but it's just the price of a pledge. It's worth it. Please call now with your pledge. Thank you. Back with record producer Sam Phillips, he discovered B.B. King, Howlin' Wolf, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, Johnny Cash, and Elvis Presley. You gave up recording in about 1963. You gave up producing records. Why did you stop?
I think that the reason being is that I've always believed in younger people coming along and taking over. It became very difficult for independent labels to make it because at that time, the major labels found out that we weren't just going to fold our tent and go away. When we started out, they thought, well, this is a passing fancy, and the chances are they won't be around long, so we'll get back to our regular curricular activities. I saw the handwriting on the wall. When you would do what you did, had to do, and your distributors had to work with you, and then the major labels would come along and offer contracts that we couldn't even think about, guarantees, because we were still very, very limited on funds. And so it was no use in me being a farm club, so to speak, for the major league club. And that's exactly what it came to be. So I decided I was not going to work because I was offered a job with RCA by Steve Scholes to go to RCA at the time I sold Elvis's contract. And I did not go because, number one, I knew I would not be of any value to RCA, because I had to do whatever I did, be it right or wrong, I had to do it, quote-unquote, the way that I felt I had to do it and the way that I felt was necessary to prove what I had set out to prove. I knew that that wasn't necessarily going to work well with a big company, and it would be absolutely no percentage. It'd be only frustration. I would accomplish absolutely nothing.
You must have, or I would imagine that you must have really missed recording people when you stopped and missed discovering people.
I'll always miss it. I sure will. I you let me hear. I bought every old record I reckon Time Life put out on CD to go back and just to hear. Do you know, I go back right now and I hear Summit Ridge Drive by Artie Shaw. Now that, you can hear absolutely some of the greatest rhythm. And this was cut in the 40s or late 30s. And, you know, I mean, music is not an option, really, with people. We take it for granted, people that are in it professionally, people that just love it to listen to, and people that can take it or leave it. But music is the single most important element outside of, I guess, we need a little oxygen to breathe in order to be able to listen to music. But there is nothing on the face of God's earth that gives us more solace in more different areas, in more different ways than music. And you better believe that if I could stay around here another 74 years and I could start all over again and have my way with a major company, or I would be recording people, because there is nothing in this world that is more rewarding, whether you got a dollar out of it or not, than working with, I mean, absolutely untried, unproven talent and seeing it come to the forefront and entertain, I mean, even the hardest-eared control man in the world behind that glass.
Sam Phillips, one last thing. I want to end with one of the records you produced, and I'll ask you to choose a favorite for us to go out with, and if there's a story behind it, to tell us the story, if you can.
Well, let me do this. I want to tell you, one of my favorite artists of all time was a guy known as C. Rich to us. His name is Charlie Rich. And when you listen to No Headstone on My Grave, I want to tell you, you are listening to a masterpiece of what life is all about. And knowing that Charlie could do just about any type of thing in this world, in addition to writing some of the greatest songs you ever heard, I would say that to go out on No Headstone on My Grave would be really the highest, highest esteemed, biggest stone in the whole cemetery.
Sam Phillips founded Sun Records and was one of the most important behind-the-scenes figures in the early history of rock and roll. Here's Charlie Rich. Our interview with Sam Phillips was recorded in 1997. Nearly 50 years ago, Phillips founded radio station WHER, billed as the first all-girl radio station in the world. On Friday, October 29th, All Things Considered will present the documentary WHER 1000 Beautiful Watts as part of the Lost and Found Sound series. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I'll see her in the by and by. Tell her that I'm fat and free from the trouble you caused me. But don't put no headstone on.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our week of interviews with cultural heroes and one-of-a-kinds. We'll feature interviews with painter Chuck Close and the late poet Allen Ginsberg. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.